got to pretend.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 7. Is it 7? It's 7, right?
I don't know. I stopped keeping track.
Of Cocktails and Screams. I am John F. Mers.
And I am Christopher Grace.
Yes, he is. And tonight we are talking about The Devil's Backbone, yes. El Espinazo del Diablo.
Ooh,
I don't speak Spanish, but that wasn't half bad. So,
but after seeing this movie, you kind of want to.
I kind of want to pick it up, honestly.
You kind of want to pick it up, so you can really, you know.
Yes, this 2001 movie by Guillermo del Toro, and takes place during the Spanish Civil War when a new kid comes to an orphanage and happens upon some supernatural stuff.
Yeah, stuff is a good what is it, noun?
Good noun. Good. It's all inclusive.
All inclusive noun.
So tonight's drink is what, Chris?
It is a Cali Mocho. I know it has an X in it, but it's pronounced Cho. It is a Spanish drink, seeing that this is a Spanish-Mexican collaboration. So you have a lot of influence from the Spanish world of filmmakers. So I decided to go with something from Spain, and supposedly this is more prevalent in Spain than even sangria.
Really?
Because it's easier to make.
It's pretty
cheaper,
easy to make.
It's cheaper than sangria.
I have my ingredients back here.
Mine are here off camera.
let me just say that any cocktail that has an X in it, I'm kind of down with trying. I think that's
exactly.
Pretty cool. Yeah. So I'm easy like that. I'm kind of a cocktail.
But yeah, without further ado, I will put this nice little.
Do the eyes thing again. Together. Do the eyes thing. Do the eyes thing again for our YouTube viewers. Because
it is Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah, that's pretty Pan's Labyrinth right there. That's pretty crazy.
A little bit of that.
All right, so what are the ingredients here?
Okay, so it takes ice, so I decided to break out the ice balls.
Oh, ice balls, all right.
That's right, I'm just going to do one at a time here so I can...
You'll be happy to know that I actually have a cooler.
Save some for later. They do, all the people out there in the liquor world say that you should use... an abundant amount of ice. I'm just going to use one liquor ball because it stays cold for a longer period of time. But they
like
say that because it's a summer drink. Right?
Yeah.
They recommend. So the next ingredient, which is really just like two ingredients and a splash of lemon. So you do about one part. Wine, they recommend a nice Spanish high tannin wine. So we got a Rioja, but really any crisp white wine, tart white wine will do. Then the next thing that they recommend you do is do the lemon squeeze.
Oh.
I always cut off the end of the lemon that I'm using for garnish. And I drop that in there. See that nice acidic lemon flowing down in there.
All right.
Then they call for a Coke, a cola. You can use any Coca-Cola, Pepsi. I like this new green cola.
I have a Pepsi.
It's kind of like Coca-Cola, only it gets its caffeine from coffee beans. Also, it's no sugar added, so it's always interesting. Then you're gonna pour that the rest of the way.
Now, do you stir this?
You can stir it if you'd like. I use a lot of them. Looks like they were floating the soda on top of the wine, and if you can see, it kind of It kind of resembles what the spirit in this movie has coming out of the top of his head.
Very, very, very true. Very true.
Like a little bit of a blood in water look. Then you want to garnish with one of those.
Mine's about halfway down the drink there. I kind of put it in ahead of time.
And so there you go.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers. Which side?
I don't know. Every time I do it, it's either one or the other. Ding. We'll get it right one of these days. All right.
That is my first Calimocho.
Calimocho.
And it's pretty amazing, actually, for what you put in it. I know John's not much of a red wine.
I am not much of a red wine drinker. That is true, but
I could probably drink about. They usually put a straw in this.
I can see why.
Drink this one.
This will go down pretty quickly.
That is very refreshing. I can see why they say that that's a summer drink.
It's not quite a cherry Coke, but it's not far off.
It's like I'm not much of a cherry Coke liker either. It's kind of like a grape Coke.
Yeah, it's like
it has that kind of more of a Welsh's tart to it. Like
you know, it almost reminds me of a Suicide Slush. Did you ever have those as a kid?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. It's not. I don't think that's too far off that flavor. That's pretty good.
I'm gonna put my lemon in there too.
Yeah, get it in there.
And I think I'm gonna make another quick one real quick.
Well, you already down your first one.
Pop this one. Well, I mean, I haven't drank all day, so.
Oh. Oh, the lemon in that is really nice.
Wow. I can't. This is starting to become my new favorite summer drink. Wow.
This is that's pretty nice.
Yeah.
I can honestly see why people get rocked on that pretty quickly.
I'm making another one.
Wait, bottle, you're not doing it the right way, though. You're just pouring the wine back into the glass again.
Yeah, I'm not even.
You're not even measuring it out. We've already moved on to after
hours. There we go. All right.
Cheers. All right. It's got a nice color, too.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Shante's, wound. Shanti is the phantasma.
Santi.
Santi. I said Shanti, didn't I? Santi. Is the
I thought you were saying Ashanti.
Actually,
who I like.
Should we say spoilers when we're talking about some of this stuff? Because
I mean, we don't really spoil things.
Well,
whatever. So there's a ghost.
We won't spoil it.
You know?
So there is a spirit. It's in this. All this takes place in an orphanage. Around 1939-ish, like right in the Spanish Civil War, right before World War II. My brain. Right before World War II, there's a lot of turmoil going on in Europe at the time. A lot of power transfers and power struggles.
Yeah.
And then you center this at an orphanage with a bunch of kids that people kind of tossed off.
Their parents were killed in the fighting. Yeah.
Yeah, the parents were killed in the fighting. Diplomats that didn't have time to deal with their kids So they are being watched over by a doctor,
Dr. Cesares,
and a kind of mother of the house.
Matriarch, Carmen.
Their characters, it's weird because the whole time you're really wondering who kind of the story's villain is.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these, they want to show these orphans have to deal with a lot. And there's also another character who is a long time orphan. His name is Juanito. And he's kind of like the handyman that's left around the orphanage, but he also used to be an orphan from there. Yeah. I guess the other orphans that used to live in his era at the orphanage moved on, or, you know, that's the other thing. I don't know. Why is this guy not fighting in the Civil War? And he's hiding. He's like, it's almost like you're really starting to see this guy's character on a subplot kind of level, because you're like, is he at the orphanage hiding or dodging the Spanish Civil War, or like what's going on with that?
And, well, Dr. Casares and Carmen are both, you know, aligned with the Republicans, and Jacinto is much more with the nationalists, and he knows. Yeah. He knows that there's a store of gold somewhere in the orphanage, and he wants to get that gold partially for himself and partially to help out the nationalists. So I kind of took it as he was on, not that he was undercover, but he's sort of figuring out, you know, if I can get my hands on this gold, this is my path into, you know, not only what I want to achieve for myself, but also for the country. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So this is being produced by a pretty well-known and renowned filmmaker, Pedro Almodovar.
Oh, yeah.
And so a lot of these actors, like the woman who plays Carmen, Marissa Paradis.
Yep.
She has worked with him a bit.
Oh, countless films, right?
Who's in All About My Mother and, yeah. You know... also, the doctor, he's worked with Almodovar. The cinematographer has worked with him. But Guillermo was tapped to do this movie, and they made a Mexican-Spanish co-collaborative co-production. This was after his kind of had a bad go in his film preceding this, was called Mimic.
Oh, yeah, I remember
produced
that.
By Bill or Bob and Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
Great human beings. No wonder he had problems with them, and he didn't like any of experience. One of his Guillermo's friends at the time, James Cameron, almost went to blows with Harvey Weinstein at the Oscars that year.
Probably should have.
Because of how he treated Guillermo during the Mimic, the whole process of getting Mimic out. And, you know, he was really, he was trying to blacklist Guillermo, I believe, during this whole period. So when he showed up with Devil's Backbone that year, and it was getting praise, I guess little bully Harvey didn't like that. So, but he, you know, Guillermo, you can't beat, talent, you know, it doesn't matter who you are,
right?
How much press or pull you have and access to manipulating the environment you have, with money or threats, your talent, if you're talented, no one's going to be able to stop you.
Right.
And the fact that he was able to make Devil's Backbone for a little under $5 million, and it did what it did,
yep.
It catapulted him into being able to, he instantly got signed on to do Hellboy. His artistry for the amount of money being spent was like nobody could compete. So,
and we've talked about that before. We've talked about film directors who are able to take a small budget and really squeeze it for everything and just make an amazing masterpiece with what they have.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you and I are both on the same page. I really admire somebody that can take, you know, a $4.5 million budget and produce the level of film quality that is in this movie. You know,
oh yeah. Well, like from the set design and the wardrobe and the
atmosphere,
just the artistry and the frame.
Yep.
For the money being spent, you're really shaking your head about how many people put in favors, but at the end of the day, that's part of it. You know, like if you can produce, it doesn't really matter why or how or
right.
or what your capabilities are as far as behind the camera or behind the and during pre-production. If you put it all towards the screen, which probably what happened with Mimic is you have ego in the form of huge executive producers who are always taking your cut. You have a $20 million movie, you might only be putting $5 million into it.
Yeah, because everybody else has got their hand out.
They got their hand out, or they made one phone call so they won $100,000, or, you know, like I pulled a favor, one favor. And then you get films like this that are multi-country collaborations.
Yeah, can you imagine?
The industry is just, you know.
Stunning.
Somebody should take a little page out of their book and start making studio films like that.
Yeah.
Instead of having a lot of above the line cash going out. So,
and it's amazing too, because there are so many scenes in this movie that are just, I don't want to say they take you out of the movie because they're so beautiful, but there are a lot of really beautifully shot scenes in this movie that, you almost lose the story because I found myself sitting there just staring in wonder at what was on the screen in front of me going, it's gorgeous. The composition, you know, the lighting, just everything together really makes this.
That's Guillermo Navarro.
Navarro, yeah.
Yeah, he actually he didn't start with them, but it was kind of like, I guess they met their artistic sapatico when they met. He shot Guillermo's first feature called Kronos.
Yep.
And then after that, it was just like, they pretty much interacted all the time. But yeah, Navarro, I've known about him. Like, I wanted to find out who, for instance, when Robert Rodriguez made his El Mariachi, the follow-up to El Mariachi.
Once Upon a Time in Mexico?
Desperado.
Oh, Desperado, okay.
I instantly went out and watched that because I loved El Mariachi. Like his book called Rebel Without a Camera.
Right.
A Rebel Without a Crew.
Yeah.
Was pretty insightful for me as a young filmmaker.
Yep.
So when Desperado came out, I watched it and I was like, this guy is making a $7 million movie and getting this. And it looked like this and it moved like this. So that's when I got introduced to Navarro, because Navarro shot that movie.
Yeah.
Because his work was seen in Kronos. So all of these people in the background collaborating, then he went and rode the Robert Rodriguez and Lawrence Bender and Quentin Tarantino trained for a little bit, but he did Dust Till Dawn and Jackie Brown. Like Jackie Brown, the camera work in Jackie Brown, if you haven't seen Jackie Brown, Jackie Brown is probably one of Tarantino's best films.
Absolutely.
Underrated.
Underrated. Yeah.
But yeah, this guy really knows his camera work. And then when you watch this movie and you're looking at the budget and you see all this stuff and all the artists, you're just like quit making everybody look bad.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no coincidence why the Spanish Mexican connection exploded in Hollywood is because when they showed up at the door, they didn't have a password.
Right.
They didn't ask to come in. They said, we aren't asking.
Yeah.
We're coming in because our talent.
Here you go.
our talent is better than yours. And if you want to like say we're going to keep you out, it's going to be because you're jealous.
Right.
And he's like, so pretty much towards the end of the 90s and the beginning of 2000, if it wasn't for they call themselves the Three Amigos, what's the name? what's his name? He did Gravity. My brain went.
I don't know.
Grosso. Oh yeah. Gonzalez Inturrito. I'm butchering that, and Alfonso Cuarón.
Okay.
So, like, in Guillermo's, they even started a production company in 2000, I think, called Cha-Cha-Cha, and started, like, really going after studio pictures and
nice.
Hellboy and, you know, and, I mean, that's a whole nother thing. I won't go down that rabbit hole, like with stuff like The Revenant and like just they're just continuing to dominate as far as filmmakers.
Yeah, thankfully, because as viewers we get to reap the rewards. I mean, it's just incredible stuff. But yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the plot of the movie. So it's Carlos arrives at the orphanage. He kind of falls in with, you know, another kid called Jaime or Jamie.
Jamie, who started out being like, just like every other kid,
right,
who was the leader. And then this other really strong charactered individual shows up. He kind of confronts him, bullies him a little bit. Yeah.
And they sort of come together. And meanwhile, Carlos has been seeing this ghost. What they call the sighing one.
The sighing one, yeah.
Yeah. And he starts talking to the other boys about it, and there's, you know, all these legends, and there's a giant bomb, literally, in the middle of the courtyard of this orphanage that was dropped by a bomber and never exploded, and they defused it, and then they just left this ginormous, incredible bomb sitting in the middle.
It's kind of like the statue. It becomes kind of like the god of it, because the orphans would go out and talk to it, like,
right,
it was in charge, like it was doing things, like it had the power around.
You know. Yeah, and they like to say that you could still hear it ticking.
Yeah,
you put your ear up to it. So the presence of the bomb, I thought it was an interesting visual imagery, just a constant reminder that the war is all around them, and you know, having the bomb in the courtyard there is just smack right in your face every time you walk anywhere. Oh yeah, there's a war going on literally outside of these walls, and as a result inside of the walls as well. So.
And supposedly the character of the bomb was also connected to the character of what happened,
right,
to the one that sighs.
Because
it's actually it's the bomb that Carlos goes and talks to the bomb to help him find
Santi. Where
Santi is.
Yeah.
Like, where is he? Where's the one that sighs? And yeah,
he's led that way.
He's led that way from supposedly the spirit of the war, of war, just
of
or
war,
battling,
yeah,
or you know, or turmoil, or whatever the representation of that bomb was. It was either the war, which was the obvious one, but also I think was the internal turmoil within the plot, within the story that's going on. Is this, there was this always this ominous part of the story that was obviously everywhere in the atmosphere of this environment, and it was the one thing driving it. So to actually incarnate it that way was pretty brilliant screenwriting and storytelling.
Yeah.
You know?
And even, I mean, again, going back to just the graphical images in this movie, the bomb itself, you know, you can see the rivets on the side. It's been rusting because it's been exposed to the elements. And every time the bomb appears in the frame, it's positioned in such a way that you can almost feel the texture of this thing. And it's just, it's so amazing. It's like,
and it has its own sound and its own soundtrack. You know, it has its own kind of voice. It almost speaks with the way it creaks and tings from the inside. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's at a slant in the ground, and you know, I spent a lot of the movie wondering if it was finally going to tip over at some momentous occasion, you know? Yeah. Well, they supposedly defused it. Right.
Yeah.
But you don't know. So all this stuff is going on, and you know, Dr. Casares has come to the orphanage from Argentina, and he's got a he's in love with Carmen, who doesn't really reciprocate to him. In fact, she's
she's just self-conscious. She doesn't have a leg.
Right. Yeah, she's
lost her leg, so
she's got a prosthetic. She's
very self-conscious.
Yep. But
there's December, June kind of love affair going on between.
And Jacinto is banging her for lack of a more refined, eloquent, there's no eloquence here tonight, apparently.
He is turning leather into lace, let's call it that. He's helping her become the lace she used to be, you know.
I'll use the term from Bloom County, snuggle bunnies. Snuggle bunnies.
They're doing some snuggle bunnies.
Right.
So it was almost, maybe I'm digging deeper into it, but this woman has known this kid, or since this younger man, since he was an actual orphan underneath her care.
Yeah.
And now he's kind of the fix-it guy there.
Yeah.
Fix this and fix that, and every night he's going to fix her.
Right.
And you kind of start thinking, is like, when did that start?
I don't know.
It was especially
since when they finally cracked that there's a safe in the orphanage where the store of gold is.
Yes.
And when Jacinto finally gets access to it, he finds a notebook with his name on it, and there's all these pictures of him and all this other stuff.
I'm wondering if they were kept from him.
I don't know. I wasn't sure whether that was her stash or what, but
they showed her looking at stuff. If you look in some of the previous scene, they see her looking at some stuff. There was when she was in the safe before.
Yeah.
When he came in.
Yeah.
And she shut it real quick and ran him out of there.
Yeah.
When it became this whole thing and he divulged the fact that they had been sleeping together, and she smacks him with the cane and he runs away like a wounded hyena.
Yeah.
She had been looking at stuff. She had, that booklet that was there was out. And I think previously, and even back further when the safe was in the picture, it was almost like it was all like, there was two treasures in that safe.
Yep.
I guess what they were trying to exploit is there was this this gold, which was to most society would be the treasure. But if you're looking at it from an orphan, your past or your story or where you came from was probably more. So that scene where his friends from the resistance
Nationalists
are like, there is no gold here. You're an idiot.
Yeah.
We're leaving tomorrow. This and that. The scene where you really think, okay, this guy who up to this point we didn't know he was a villain until around this period in the story, is obviously the villain. But you look at him, there was almost a moment where you were thinking, okay, this guy is about to have a redemptive moment.
Yeah.
But I guess it showed that he was a little too far gone, and that that knowing that he did have a past and his parents were who they were wasn't enough to
redeem him,
make up for all the time that had passed and the languishing at this, you know.
And his actions in the past as well, you know.
Yeah.
So Dr. Casares, you know, has come from Argentina. He's been here at the orphanage for, what, 20 years, I think he says at some point.
Yeah.
He's trying to get Carmen to leave, and she is concerned about the boys. Who's going to look after the boys? Well, Dr. Casares goes to the nearby village, and he's selling some stuff to get money for the orphanage.
Oh, no. That's the whole title comes from. It's right. Not just he's selling Devil's Backbone.
I wasn't sure how far you wanted to go into it. Why'd you explain
it's
that?
Like it's because they show it later on when after Shanti goes and says, bring him to me and I'll take care of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're in the doctor's thing. Well, what happened is they, there was these medical, issues with babies being born with their spinal cords outside of their body, and they didn't know what was going on. And, so they would preserve these fetus And these,
no, it wasn't a fetus. It was
well, they, some of them were fetus, some of them were already born, but they were in these big jars. But instead of using formaldehyde to preserve them, they would use spices and rum, old rum. So it had been distilling in with these babies, with these exposed backbones, which were they called the devil's backbone, and he was selling that
bottles of it.
Bottles of it, because they looked at it as they were cures to like erectile dysfunction and cures to whatever ails you, right?
I love how he
actually offers some of it to Carlos.
Carlos, yeah,
because he seems to be getting nightmares because he's saying the one that size comes to him. So he asked him, "Do you believe in ghosts?" He's like, "Well, here, I'll talk to you about real ghosts."
The
devil's backbones that were preserved in these jars. I thought it was
hysterical how he's explaining the drink to Carlos, who is like 11 or 12.
Yeah, he's 12
years old.
He's
talking about, well, you
no,
know.
No, I haven't seen anything. You're right, I'm going back to bed. And then he leaves, and he's like, okay.
He's talking to the kid, and he's like, well, you know, it's really good for impotence. 11 or 12-year-old has any idea what that is.
Yeah, there were really good devices that were used where you kind of you don't really see who the bad, like who are the bad guy or the villain or the bad one, like with Carmen or the doctor they all kind of have things where they aren't really the best examples of human beings. And they're all responsible for rearing these children.
Yeah, yeah.
One of which, well, you know, spoiler alert, one of which was, like, you can call it an accident. They portrayed it as kind of an accident. But you beat around a kid enough, they're not going to make it. So, he gets killed. So, like, you really start to look at this whole picture as trying to show a kind of a subliminal or deep dive look into how war and poverty and separation anxiety does to children. And that if you're looking at things, it's not really a horror movie. I mean, it was shown as a horror movie, but it really shows that a lot of the horrors that most people look at, like things that go bump in the night, the real horrors are the human beings that are harsh on other human beings.
Exactly.
And war and other types of things. So I liked that aspect of, that's one of the reasons I brought this up, other than the fact that it kind of was, other than Mimic's kind of a toss off, but that's not Guillermo's fault. That's Harvey Weinstein's fault, among other things. But this really solidified him as a filmmaker being able to handle any budget you gave to him. If you can do this for $5 million, imagine what you get to do with like 80 to 100 million when you make Hellboy. Imagine what you're going to get to do.
Well, he's got, and that's a really good point too, because we're talking about $4.5 million. He's got Santi, who is the ghost in this movie, you know, appears on screen, and you know, given when this came out in 2001, special effects in this movie are really good. They're not over the top. You're not going to sit there and go, oh yeah, that's like so CGI. It was really, really well done.
Another drink. I'm listening.
It was really, really well done, and I think again to your point, you know, just speaks to how he's able to take capital and execute on it in such a way that he really gets an outstanding result. You know,
I don't think you need. I think it's always underestimated how much human capital is in filmmaking. People lose the representation of a collaboration. If your goal is to make a movie, you can make an amazing movie for not a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody there is there to make a movie, to make a good story, to make a movie.
Right.
If your goal is to make money, then there is ways in the film industry to inflate a budget, exploit the project for that gain.
Right.
People get their gain and they could care less what makes it to the screen.
Yeah.
Like, and it just shows a perfect example of what it looks like when a group of artistic collaborators look at a story and go, this is pretty amazing story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It also has all the elements that Hollywood likes.
Right.
Right. And it helps to tell a very important story from the Spanish speaking world's past.
Right.
So it really weave things and make things part of a bigger story when most of the people, and especially there's a lot of American filmgoers aren't going to watch this movie just so that, cause they don't want to read subtitles.
Yep.
You know, this movie made me want to freshen up on my Spanish because it's just how steeped in, like, there was a line that I'm just, if you're talking about ghosts and like, there's so many ghost stories have been talked about and the narrator is the doctor, like the doctor's the narrator of telling the story.
Right.
And he has kind of has this phantasma speech at the beginning and at the end. And part of that speech, he mentions, he asks, what's a ghost? And he goes down a list of what it is. An emotion suspended in time.
Right.
Like hit me. And I'm like, that's the most poetic example of what a ghost is.
Yeah.
You know,
and he says that at the beginning of the movie.
At the beginning and at the end. And you're just kind of like,
when it came in the beginning of the movie, I kind of sat up and went, okay, you know, we're obviously going like, to be in for a treat here. You know,
the whole time, which I really like, and a lot of people might have missed it, that like, but the whole time you're being told a story by a ghost.
Right.
Almost like the Sixth Sense, you know. The whole time there's a man you're hearing the story from, then you find out the man speaking is the doctor who's telling the story. Then in the process telling the story, you notice that the doctor gets killed. And then he comes back to speak to the audience at the end to reestablish that all he is a ghost, but even he has a story to tell.
Right.
And even the ghost of this orphan has a story to tell. The orphans that live have a story to tell. The Spanish people have a story to tell.
Yeah.
And it was like, for me, so I saw Devil's Backbone before, like kind of the year it came out, maybe the year after. I saw it the year it came out. Maybe 2002. It might have been the year after. But after seeing these things and then you look at all of the other fluff that comes out and multi-million-dollar tentpoles that are just horribly crafted and like almost look like they've been thrown together for $100 million, and you're just kind of like, I'm not taking these people serious anymore. You really, it kind of weeds out the reality. It's like, you know, don't. So, which was a big reason why I wanted, actually, what was it, 2 or 3 episodes ago, I brought up maybe we should do Devil's Backbone. It was when we were talking about what Carpenter did with $5 million.
Right.
In the 80s.
Yep.
You know, and then he got $10 million in the 90s to make another one of his sequels. And then 4.5, 5 years later, Guillermo is given less than $5 million and makes this movie.
Yeah.
And exactly. You look at these people and that people hit revere and talk about this or talk about that. And you're just kind of like, what? What is there to revere? I mean, yeah, I guess in their microcosm you can. But when you exploit film on a global scale and you really distill it down and you start seeing the nuts and the bolts of what it takes to get a film made. And these people, some people are doing this and some people are doing that. And this is $10 million thrown together. And even 5, 6 years later, where money is more expensive.
Yep.
and are doing 100 to 1,000 times better quality in it.
Yep.
Like you said, even the CG, it didn't advance that much from the what was it? Trying to think of the movie that came out. I guess didn't T3 come out like in 96 or 7 or
something like that? Yeah.
And you know that was kind of, The Abyss. I guess The Abyss.
Oh, The Abyss, yeah.
James Cameron. Which you kind of start thinking, well, if they were friends, maybe James Cameron was like, "Hey, I got some CG stuff you might be able to look into."
Yeah.
You know.
But there's, yeah. I mean, just staying on the CG for a second. I mean, there's a really nice effect where Santi, the phantasma, the ghost, is walking. And he's got blood because you'll find out later he gets like basically thrown into a wall.
And then the thing is, I like is he's thrown in the pool. And as a spirit, the wound is bleeding as if it's underwater.
Well, that's what I was getting ready to say. He's walking towards Carlos and the wound is still bleeding like it's underwater. It was just a really nice,
and there's things floating around it,
yeah,
like it's underwater,
yeah,
and
yeah.
You think, and there's always these flies around the dead people in this,
right,
movie, but he didn't have any flies around him. It was just like these particles and things floating around him,
yeah,
to where it really established. There's another movie came out a little bit later called that I kind of like. A lot of people didn't like it. I think it was a remake called Stir of Echoes with Kevin Bacon.
Okay.
And they did similar things in that movie to show that a ghost is an emotion trapped in time. That something bad happens.
Yeah.
And the spirit or the phantasma exists in this kind of stagnant state.
Yeah.
That everything around it has an origin and it's stuck with them.
Right.
Like the head wound and the wheezing and the one that sighs, you know, he's not really what that sighing is the blood. And they, when they reenact what actually happened, it's his skull gets cracked.
Yeah.
And there's pressure being released and it's wheezing through the skull going.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that sound is continued underwater as, you know, the brain cavity brings in water and extracts the blood. And it's and it really goes into a lot of Guillermo's future work in character design and like him drawing things out. And I read earlier today, re-diving into this, that he had written this before Kronos, or the original script, and it had a bunch of other things. Like there was going to be these other entities or spirits or things where they were red from head to toe.
Really?
There was another one where they were going to, like, originally, supposedly, either the doctor or some, maybe it was Carmen's care, somebody was going to be represented as a being with three arms, and there was really out there stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, seeing Pan's Labyrinth, you kind of wanted to see that now. But when you look at when you think of a filmmaker's vision, and you see what he did with just the idea of a ghost.
Right.
And then how he, and you fast forward to like Pan's Labyrinth, and he brought an actual Pan to life,
mm-hmm,
in a very real, like Pan is probably one of the most realistic characters made inside of the camera that I've seen, and even with The Shape of Water, what he was able to do with his creature of the Black Lagoon, you know. And it was just he continues to, which doesn't make, when I heard that they were remaking, or they were going to be making, what are they called? Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark series.
Right. Yeah.
And that he was helming it. I mean, first I get mad because I'm like, damn it. Because since I was a kid and wanted to be a filmmaker, that was one of the things, I only saw it as like a TV series.
Yeah.
And have Steven come and do the artwork and actually do a kind of a cartoon world of that. But then when I saw that he was the one that was going to handle that material, I was like, the freaking, they're going to bring those things out on the page. And then to have Andre come and be the director on that, and it was a perfect storm, and I loved what they did with that. I really wish it would have been a rated R movie though.
Yeah. Hold on. Let me pause you right here for just a second. And we're back. Sorry, I forgot to sneak the commercial break in early.
It's all right. I always forget that there's commercials for Anchor.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're watching this on YouTube, we also have it on Anchor. If you just want to go jogging or something and listen to us ramble about the Devil's Backbone.
Yep, we are everywhere you get your podcast: Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, you name it, we're there. And we're also open to sponsorships too. So if you'd like to sponsor an episode,
Or you're one of these nice wine companies and want to send us a case of wine, or
you've got a suggested cocktail.
Or you own a huge national conglomerate of liquor that you want to support us, you can do that. And
who could that be?
You know.
So with The Devil's Backbone, though, I think it's important to point out, if you go into this movie thinking it's going to be a horror flick, it is and it isn't.
It's a horror film for people that aren't a one-dimensional horror fan.
Right, exactly.
You know, when you start realizing how the plethora of horror that's out there from literature, you start realizing that jump scares is a very small sliver of the pie.
Right.
When you like for me, this is horror. Like, this is like a dread-filled Edgar Allan Poe yarn.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to do it. It's very much a creeping process that slowly reveals itself.
Horror is a human being. Horror is human nature and human.
I was saying to Chris before we started recording that I went through the majority of this movie thinking that I knew who the villain was, and it turned out that that wasn't the villain after all. So, you know, when it finally does get revealed,
what is it like when the kids went all Lord of the Flies?
Yeah, there's a Lord of the Flies scene.
Like, you kind of be like, well, maybe their future,
right?
Like,
right,
no one is getting out of the story fully redeemed.
Yeah, nobody's leaving without scars.
No, and you be like, you know, you can't hold it against them. You're kind of cheering for them, but that's a horrible scene.
Yeah,
you go from seeing this guy who's kind of really one of the best bad guys in a movie.
Yeah,
who is non-redeemable and even been attempted to be redeemed and can't be, and then that happens to him, and you're kind of like, yeah, but then you're kind of like, oh. So the first ones, you're kind of like, yeah, and then a stick goes through his arm, and you're like, oh, yeah, I gotta stop.
It goes into the armpit.
Oh, stuck him like a pig. That's like the worst place. You're like, ah. Like,
that was Jacinto's character was played by Eduardo Noriega. And
yeah.
It's a phenomenal
performance. He's a brilliant actor.
Really is.
Yeah.
My personal favorite, I mean, I've seen Marisa Paredes before. I really thought Federico Lupi as Dr. Casares was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
That, you know, the amount of empathy that he had, you know, the way he called Carlitos, you know, it was very heartwarming. And then when you find out that he's actually the ghost that's telling this story, it was sort of like, oh man. He does a great job of sucking you in emotionally, and then at the final reveal, it's this is a special movie.
That's kind of the reason why, because we were it's multi-layered on why I wanted to bring this into this show. But it kind of sets a stand. Like, I live with a certain standard, and I guess the more people watch this, and the more they're involved, the more they're around me, they start realizing that you got to bring a lot more to a genre to get me to set up and take notice.
Yeah.
Because Cocktails and Screams exists for the purposes of imbibing and talking about horror movies. We could have called it Cocktails and Cries, and it'd have been about dramas or whatever, you know, but that doesn't have the nice
Cocktails and Christmas, and it would have been about Lifetime movies or Hallmark movies.
Cocktails and Cards.
There you go, you know.
But it shows like that, like scary films or horror films aren't one-dimensional scary.
Yeah.
Okay. And you really can start segregating the viewership based on how dimensional their knowledge of the platform it is. And when you know, I see threads all the time where people are like, what's your favorite scary or horror film? And, you know, I'm no knock on it, 'cause it has its own qualities to it, but you got like Paranormal Activity is like my favorite. And it's like, I can understand that there's a certain representation.
Yeah.
To me, that's a one-dimensional story.
Yeah.
Like, for me, horror films is you have something that is shows the darker side of the human condition, and it's in the film environment. Mm-hmm. The only secondary dimensional type thing that a movie like Paranormal Activity is the use of modern technology and modern editing to adapt a story to a more, to a cheaper or fixed perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But that movie made after this movie
had
the same amount of money. Well, they say it was made for $1 million, but it wasn't, maybe it was made for $1 million, but it wasn't put out in the world for $1 million. I mean, it had print and advertising that probably made it $5 million worldwide after it was distributed or sent to through distribution.
No doubt.
And doing A&R and stuff like that. But so there's just a certain, I think it's important for what we're doing is that the Screams part of this, Cocktails and Screams, is you need to be able to expand your idea of horror.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and don't let, like, how many horror films people are losing opportunity to see if they're just stuck to the English language, it's just a shame.
Yep.
You know, it's just a shame. You don't have the original Let the Right Ones In, mm-hmm. right? You don't have the original The Eye. You don't, you aren't experienced, you aren't given reference to really, really amazing international cinemas of, and when you really look at horror as an American genre, it's kind of one of the only ones that you realize if you turn the sound down or just put a decent score to it, the good ones, you can not have to deal with translation.
Yep.
And that's kind of what this movie too is. If you just watch it with a score, you can follow what's going on because the acting's impeccable.
Yeah.
The set design's intriguing. The movement in the frame, the editing and the pacing, everything's working to where if you're not going to watch this movie because you're going to have to read what's at the bottom of the screen, I say watch it and don't worry about reading.
Yeah.
Read the little small byline that this movie is about. Go in with that understanding and just watch the frame.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you it will become a movie that you think about more than once.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like, there's a lot of horror movies from America that you watch and you just think about it once.
You throw it away
but
after
then,
you're done.
But there's imagery in this movie, even if just the image gets through your cortex,
yeah,
into your brain through that visual cortex, you will live with it.
Yeah.
Like you said, the image of the crooked bomb.
Yeah.
It's such a perfect frame for what war is.
Right.
Is this crooked space, this crooked environment, this broken, rusted old thing that doesn't seem to do anything for society, but there it is staring at us. Every day we're looking at it. And it's just like these really profound imagery that's lost for people that are stuck with a one-dimensional understanding of horror films. Mm-hmm. There's my rant.
I completely agree, and I think it was also really telling that you've got a cast here of, you know, the better, not exactly a dozen kids, but you've got, you know, about eight kids in this cast, and every one of them, even the small minor roles, these kids are amazing.
Yeah.
You know, they're believable. You know, they've got, you know, empathy. I mean, you feel for them. And just to go back to the bomb for a second, I kind of feel like, you know, talking about the difference between American cinema and say, you know, overseas cinema, wherever it's from, I really think that if this had been an American production, you would have had an executive somewhere going, okay, so when does the bomb fall over and explode? You know, because I think that'd just be like really amazing. And I think Del Toro could have done that in this movie.
Well, there was another explosion in this movie, but it was perpetrated by, again, human beings.
Exactly. And the bomb,
they could have been like, well, why don't we just have the bomb go off?
Because
there's no connection to the human connection to it. You would have lost that development into that character if that had just happened.
It just would have been a cheap effect. It really would have been. And somebody lesser talented than Del Toro would have given into that temptation and make it a tension device. Where I'm going to put this bomb in the middle of the courtyard, everybody's going to be on the edge of their seat, trying to figure out when the bomb's going to go off. I'm not even going to do that. I don't need to do that because I've got tension going on all over the place elsewhere. You know, this is just this, like you said, it's just a symbol of the uselessness of war.
Even for the little elements, like, and it had to be in the plot, because usually when you're writing a script and you have something that's representing some sort of archetypical, some totem that you have in a story, when the guy kid wants to be the main kid, not Carlito, but the one that was already there.
Oh, Jaime.
Jaime. He trades for this ring.
Yeah,
this
ring
that used to go on a cigar, but it looks like a gold ring. And you know, like, you learn more, a lot about this kid's strong character, that he's not just a bully,
right?
But he cares about the environment that he is, and he'll fight for it.
Yeah,
whether you're a little kid outsider or somebody else, there's a moment in the movie where he gives that to one of the females that is there that's helping out, one of the other teachers that is there helping out. She's played by Irina Vecedo. He gives it to her. She cherishes it. What's his name? Eduardo, the actor Eduardo, he asks her, what was that? She says, just kid stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, he comes back with it and gives it to him after you just watched him kill her in on the road when she's trying to go get help after the explosion.
Yeah.
And he hands it to her, and the weight of that little piece of tin in that little kid's hand was ultimately the last straw that put that spear into that pig's stomach or the side. So that gave his character enough internal power or enough gumption to take his power back, that he saw that guy as a pure enemy, as somebody who has no redeeming qualities, and he needs to be smited from this planet. And even at his young teenage, like, really tossed out of the world mentality, knew what the difference between right and wrong was, and that was just the end of it.
Yeah, his use
of that little tone. I mean, you really start looking at it, it's like the script is impeccable.
Like
little elements like that, and that's just one of the little elements tied to each individual kid. Like there, like you said, there's kids in this movie that as characters are just as developed as the adults.
Yep,
which is brilliant.
Yep. And that was Jamie's story arc right there, was his transition from the kid stuff to a man. First of all, that moment where he gives what's her name?
Well, I look at it as his character could have turned out to be
Conchito.
Conchito, you know.
Conchito. Yeah. When he gives her that,
he could have turned out to be that kid, and he was on his way to becoming that person, that angst-filled, like world-hating person.
Yeah.
But because of this small little, like, respect or love that was given by somebody that didn't have to give it, but they were there to give it, changed that kid's life forever in a very strong totem of representation. And their lives just change, like their story arc, they just change.
Well, first of all, that moment where he gives Conchita the ring is really, it's just sweet. It's just very, very endearing. It's a beautiful moment. But even, you know, talking about story arcs and minor characters, even Conchita, she's not a major player in this movie. And yet,
without her, it's lost.
But, you know, what she calls kid stuff, not only is the story arc for Jamie, it's also Conchita's story arc, because that little kid stuff gives her the courage to stand up to Jacinto and say, you know what, I know you're an animal, I'm not gonna play. Like,
what's the real purpose here? Is that maybe the kid stuff is the real purpose?
Exactly. In a way,
letting these kids down and quit thinking about yourself. There's bigger things to be worried about here.
Unfortunately, Conchita, you know, her story arc ends as soon as she discovers her courage, Jacinto kills her.
Yeah, just like just like most women, is when they have enough courage to stand up, there's always weaker, usually men, there to destroy them.
Yep.
But the reality is, as I look at her character as the true hero, because, well, one of the, I guess there's three main heroes, but her character, what she went through and the arc of her character, from you just expect her to be this kind of one-dimensional character, you realize Guillermo had a lot more respect for that female character, the matriarchy of that character, than a lot of other writers would have had.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, going back to the Cocktails and Screams thing, you know, the scream portion, what's the meme that's been going around from Japan where they've got a new roller coaster and it's and they're trying not to get, because of the pandemic, they're trying not to get people to scream outwardly, so their sign translates as to scream quietly within your heart. So, you know, we don't always do the
scream internally.
Yeah, scream internally.
Offensive,
you know?
Scream.
So, but, you know, I think that's an important point with this movie, is the fact that when everything is revealed, there are moments where you actually want to scream inside of yourself. It's not a scream out loud. It's not a jump scare.
Not a jump scare. I mean, I guess you could say there's maybe one or two jump scares in this movie if you wanted to go there, but It's
a stretch.
They didn't want to go there.
No. I think the genius of this movie is what it reflects. You know, Del Toro takes in a moment, a happening, and then uses that to subtly peel back layers of human condition and human nature to the point where the truth is revealed. And when you see the truth, it's not very pretty.
No.
And that's what makes you scream. That's what makes you kind of go, oh.
It's like this long-term guttural scream.
Yeah.
in the abyss. You know, you're kind of like, it's a horror where you're screaming in an abyss.
Yeah.
You're in like James Wan's The Further, mm-hmm. and no one gives a shit.
Right.
You're out there, you're dead. It's everything's horrible. All the horrors of the world are staring at you in the face, and you can't even see them because it's such an isolated environment. And as a viewer, you're putting to perspective where you start really feeling for these characters' horrific situation.
Yep.
So, I mean, really, it was a, I look at it as a horror. If you're looking at genres, this is a horror drama.
Yep.
You know, if you took Shanti out of the situation and didn't show the ghost, mm-hmm. and say you didn't show the ghost, of course you're going to show the ghost because it's Del Toro and he likes the visceral connection to to terror and to mm-hmm. horror. But if you just took that aspect out of it and just told the story from the human side, it's a strong, strict drama.
Oh yeah,
that can just stand on itself. If it just had to be a drama,
yep.
it would have been just as valuable as a film. And then the fact that you can take it into a horror world,
right,
and connect it to two different audiences, that to me is what makes it. And not only that, to show that you're capable of transcending language,
mm-hmm.
doing so, it's a film that really needs to take representation as far as when you look at where genres go and people making these horror genre films, like what their capabilities are,
yep.
is beyond just like the horror aspect of their craft isn't a one trick pony,
right.
The really good ones, the ones that have staying power, that can like demand an audience's respect, they're always able to do more with their material
mm-hmm.
than just snap, like get a good edit and you got a jump scare, you know?
Right.
Just like,
right.
You know, so,
but I also think, you know, and we've touched on this to be sure, this movie isn't the result of just amazing direction and amazing cinematography. It starts with an amazing story, and there's not.
That is it. Yep.
You know, excuse me. I mean, you know, other movies that we've looked at, we kind of reached this point in the podcast. We're like, well, what didn't you like about it? Well, you know, there was this. This didn't really make sense to me. This movie is so well written. The story at the base of this movie is so well written. There are no problems with it. There aren't.
There's nothing to not like about this movie.
Right.
Because, I look at, there's films and then there's movies. There's things that move around and have yep. audible sound to them. Those are movies.
Right.
But what makes a film is like one where you're like, it needs a little more care
mm-hmm.
and it deserves to make it on celluloid,
yep.
you know?
Yeah.
To some extent, and it needs that. It has a tangibility to it,
mm-hmm.
not just this one-off. There's something steeped in this, and usually it goes back to how well crafted the story is.
Yeah,
and I mean, for instance, The Thing. Why is my favorite John Carpenter? There's an actual story there.
Right,
that characters are connected to. Yeah, it has a bunch of groundbreaking special effects and whatever, but there was a human story there that if there was different actors or different portrayals, you wouldn't have paid attention to those subtleties. Or this movie is just covered with subtext and subtlety, and like you said that the kid actors, they're doing things with their mannerisms that are just so precise
mm-hmm.
and well portrayed, and the timing of the camera into those kids' performances were impeccable.
Right. Yeah.
Like a lot of people, a lot of filmmakers, they look at it like, well, a star is born in the edit. And the thing is like, yeah, but if you don't have those things to begin with, you can't edit to it.
Right, exactly. Right?
If there isn't a care taken to the craft on all levels,
yeah,
you might be able to save it in pacing and music.
Maybe.
And timing and Foley. You might be able to save it, but there's just some films out there that don't need you to save it.
Yeah, and this is one of them, because I think what it comes down to is you can't save a bad story. Not without, you know, spending $20 million to basically
Well, print and advertising. $20 million in print and advertising, you might get 4 weeks
right
out of a bad story.
And, then, you know,
you're not going to get 2 decades.
No.
You're not going to get 2 decades of people going, that's impeccable filmmaking.
Exactly.
And
that's
why that guy has a career today, is because of films like that. Yeah, you don't get that with a bad story.
And, but, I mean, you and I see it all the time. I mean, you know, we're around... You know, we have Facebook connections that are, you know, independent filmmakers, and you see it. I see it because I see people posting about, oh, I just got this camera and I just got this, and now I'm going to run out and make a movie. And you see the synopsis of the movie and you already know it's going to fail because the story is terrible.
Yeah, that's why I haven't made another movie for a decade.
You know, so. They're not paying enough attention to the story. And I think this movie is a perfect example of, look, we've got an airtight story here that's impeccably written, and now we're going to layer on, we're going to gather a team.
We have a group of people that are willing to look at this story and say, I'm coming to the table because of this script.
Exactly.
And because of the artistry and passion of the people involved. Yeah. And you start realizing, oh, there is a human, there's a human production quality.
Yeah.
That money can't buy.
Yep.
And then you start realizing, wow, so that's how we don't spend $80 million on a studio picture.
Exactly.
We could have made that same movie by handing that $80 million to a group of true artists who should just be left alone to their abilities.
Yeah.
And then maybe you'll see them pump out, like, I don't know, 8 of these types of movies. Instead of one really okay movie that had to deal with a lot of print and advertising to save it.
Yeah.
Like, I honestly believe that all of the major studios or networks, like HBO and Netflix and, you know, kind of, and I think Apple is starting to realize this. They didn't initially, but I think they're starting to realize this with some of the films and television shows they're starting to get involved with, and artists that they're starting to get involved with, they're starting to realize that that has been the issue, I think, since the late 80s and early 90s in Hollywood and the Hollywood studio system, that's the problem.
Yeah.
There is really groups of people who just are there not to make money. They're there to tell stories that have a certain level of impeccable quality.
Yeah.
And that's all they care about. And if you nurture that, you don't have a bomb.
Right.
There's no bombs in that kind of filmmaking. You don't get a Godzilla in that kind of a filmmaking.
It might take a while to catch on, but it's going to find its way eventually. Enough people are going to see it who appreciate it, and then more people are going to see it. But well, I mean, yeah.
Perfect example is, I know our viewership isn't that great right now, but we're making this show that's going to be forever. Mm-hmm. Well, as long as the digits are flying through the air. And we're talking about this film.
Yep.
And I believe there's a lot of other lovers of film that realize what Del Toro and that group of really fine filmmakers out of the Spanish and out of the Mexican film community have brought to the table that no one can ever take away. And
that's, I think that's the thing. And just going back to, you know, my sort of sideways rant about, you know, indie filmmakers, you know, we see these ideas. I see, you know, people starting up productions all the time. And then I look at some of the material that's associated with their film and it's lazy. Because they haven't done the proper research on stuff. Oh, I'm going to make a movie about a CIA agent who does this, that, and the other thing. And
they have no background in that.
They have no background. They haven't talked to anybody, you know, because they're lazy. They're just in such a hurry to get something
done. It's a conglomerate of all the spy movies they've seen. And they just picked and chose what they wanted to see in this thing. But then yeah, I'm not gonna like bastardize any other filmmaker, but there is a certain level where you gotta go either do it. If you want to do it, go do it. I'm not gonna say make a movie. If you want to go make a movie, go make a movie. It's better than not going to make a movie.
True.
I particularly haven't because I realized that. Mm-hmm. I realized at some point I don't want to make that kind of, I don't want to make stuff that doesn't matter.
Right.
Like in my life, I look at maybe three or four things that I have captured on film, not maybe a whole film, but moments that I'm just looking at and I'm like, I know that a feature that has that every moment and every beat is in me. That's what I'm not going to make anymore until I can do that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, until I can have a story that's so steeped in those moments, no matter what genre you're putting it into, but especially horror, because you know you have a baked-in audience.
Yeah.
So if you already know you're gonna have a baked-in audience, why look at that and not take it seriously and not respect that baked-in audience?
Yeah.
You know, because you're just doing a disservice at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that, you know, if you want to go make a movie, go make a movie. But don't be lazy about it. Don't, you know, get your military insignias correct. You know, I mean, it's 30 seconds of research, you know. And I say that as a veteran, but it's one of those things where it's like, that's not the correct rank for that guy. That guy wouldn't be doing that. It's not that hard to figure out. It's not classified information. If you talk to the right people, you'll get the right answers. It's like, you know, you don't have $1 million to make a movie, but you have 15 minutes to go.
And if you want to do it right.
Yeah, you do it right.
They're going to want to help you.
Right.
Like if your persona is, if you're putting a persona out in the world that you want to be a filmmaker that makes not even product, just wants, that's the other thing is I think a lot of it is young indie filmmakers that are caught up in this idea of also making a product. So they start conforming to what has worked before. But if you're paying attention and your thumb is on the zeitgeist, you realize that none of that exists anymore.
Right.
Like, I think you're better off instead of trying to kowtow to the tropes that worked before, you want to connect to tropes that work for you.
Right.
Or things that aren't tropes at all, but just things that you see differently.
Exactly.
That's always going to catch more than things that have everybody seen already.
Yep. And pretty soon your tropes are going to become the industry norm that everybody else is copying.
Like what Guillermo did with this.
Exactly.
He connected things and so much of Hollywood mimicked it.
Yep.
And when you see, then you see a groundbreaking groundswell of what Pan's Labyrinth was, and it changed how people made set design. It changed how people built worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood was like, crap. we need to bring our A game from now on.
Yeah.
Just on a set design level. Not talking about it. And even and it sets a precedence, like we can't put this story out here anymore. This story doesn't even come close to the intricacies of what Pan's Labyrinth did,
right,
or what this movie did.
So, and again, I think it's important to point out that, like, you don't necessarily have to make a Devil's Backbone movie. You know, I have stories. I want to tell a werewolf story.
Yeah.
Tell a werewolf story, but do it in a way that's unique and is your view on it, as opposed to just being like, well, it's a full moon, guess it's gonna be a werewolf, here we go, you know, that kind of shit. It's like, you know, do some research, don't be lazy about the story, create something so that when you do put it onto film, it's gonna resonate with people. And this is what the genius of this movie is, that, you know, 20 years later, this thing resonates. It still resonates. You know, probably even harder than it did back when it was first released.
Yeah, I don't understand. That's to go back. I'm not going to ever belittle anybody else that wants to go out and make a film. But what I do see a lot is there's a lot of indie filmmakers or kids, or even people our age that are out trying to make movies. And they just haven't I guess either seen enough of the movies that are similar to what they're trying to do, or they're not aware. Like, you hear a lot of like, well, oh, you talk to them, it's like, these people, like, oh, I've never seen that. There's a lot of filmmakers out there that make really great work, and then you talk to them, and they're like, well, I never saw that, or I never saw this. And I kind of thinking, yeah, right. You're just trying to have a persona of these things come natural to me.
Right.
I'm like,
right.
No, they don't.
Yeah, there's no.
They don't just come natural to you.
There's no shame.
There's a lot of studying that goes in.
Right.
Some things come natural, like the eagerness to put down a story into film. Mm-hmm. Like, there's an eagerness.
Sure.
Like with Guillermo, like, he had an eagerness at an early age to take his dad's Super 8 camera, like a lot of early independent filmmakers, and go and actually start capturing the images they have in their head.
Yeah.
Onto some sort of device or celluloid or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can do without any influence outside of yourself. But if you really want to craft really good stories and you want to tell things that last 2 decades or 3 decades or 4 decades or 100 years, and they're still renowned and there's still people talking about it, you have to pay the ghosts that came before you.
Yep,
you have to do, like you said, do the research. It's more than just Wikipedia. You want to tell a story about operatives in the CIA, then what I recommend you do is Google top CIA or top spy movies of the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then go down that list and watch every one of those. Then you start to write your story,
because then
you'll realize that you're going to find a way to not repeat yourself or repeat those ghosts from the past. And you find a new kind of way. Like Bob Dylan says, there's only one song, you just sing it differently.
Right.
So if you're a filmmaker and you're not learning how to sing those songs differently, you're doing yourself a huge disservice.
So here's a true story. So hopefully listeners of this podcast know that I write books for a living. So
they do now.
I do now, right. They do
and
now.
As you talk, I'm going to start to make me another. God, this drink is so good.
No, so, you know, when you start out as a writer, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, right? When I started out writing back in the early 90s, I was writing short stories and I was writing novels. And I picked Stephen King as my short story model. I read everything I could that Stephen King wrote in terms of short stories, because I like Stephen King's short stories more than I like his novels. I think he is one of the true masters of the short story format. And so he was who I modeled my short stories after. For novels, it was David Marl, who wrote The Brotherhood of the Rose, which I think is probably one of the finest espionage thrillers around, just bar none. So when I finally got my first publishing deal in 2001, I had, you know, The Fixer was my very first book that was going to be published, and it was book one of my Lost and Vampire series. I went to a reading by Robert Parker, who wrote the Spencer novels, and I printed out my manuscript, and I had no plan. And I walked up to him when he was done. He was signing books, and I had one of his books. And I said, you know, Mr. Parker, I've been a fan of yours for a long time, which was the truth. I read all the
stuff. Which a lot of people don't have the balls to do either. They want to call themselves artists, or they want to call themselves doers, but they don't have the balls to actually go and put themselves out there for ridicule or to meet their giants and be destroyed, you know.
Well, so, you know, so I went up to him and I said, you know, it's because of you and authors like you that I became a writer, and I just got my first publishing contract. And he said, congratulations, you know, I'm really happy for you. And I said, you know, I would be honored if you would read my novel and give me a blurb.
And he's like, how many people do you think did that?
Well, here's the source of one of my greatest regrets in life, right? He takes my manuscript and he looks at me and he says, do you want me to read this or do you want me to blurb it? And being a completely new writer and innocent in the ways of the publishing world, I said, I want you to blurb it, because I thought that was the most valuable thing that he could give me. His name carried weight. in the publishing world, and I thought,
should have just asked for the read, man.
Yeah, exactly. I should have just asked for the read, because
blurbing is ego. Reading is me willing to do what is necessary to be on that side of the signing table.
So he took it and he said, okay, no problem. He, you know, his demeanor didn't change. A week later, I had a great blurb from him that my agent then took and got me a new publishing deal.
That was nice of him. Yeah.
It was very nice of him, but
I don't think he would have done it if it wasn't good, though, you know?
No, yeah, true. But, yeah, it wasn't – I mean, the novel wasn't a piece of shit by any means. But looking back now with 20-plus years beyond in the publishing world, it's a great regret of mine, because he was a master of writing, and I had the chance to get, you know, basically schooled by him if he had read my book. And then, you know, who knows what he would have said to me. He could have said, you know, if you do this and you do this – then you're going to be firing on all cylinders. And I think about the time I could have possibly saved and the lessons that I could have learned that would have been more valuable than the blurb, you know? So your point, the education is absolutely essential. You can't take shortcuts. You can't, there's no shame in being educated. There's no shame in saying, well, you know, I'm studying this director's films. I mean, even for this podcast, I'd never seen this movie before. I think it's phenomenal. I can't believe I hadn't seen it before, because it's amazing. So, I mean, thank you for recommending it, first of all. And,
yeah, the, you know, like, don't ever let your ego cheat you out of a lesson, you know?
Yeah.
I don't care how old you are. And I'll, even moreover, if you are a young filmmaker, and even if you're in a room with giants and you have to show some level of peership, and you try to do that by ego, That's a mistake.
Yeah.
The best thing you can do, if you want to be a peer to giants in an industry or whatever you're doing, is listen to their story.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to their feedback, and don't ever, and humble yourself in their in their presence to enough to, people know when you're dealing with an asshole. I'm not saying humble yourself to jerks or assholes,
right.
You're pretty quick to know that. But if you know you're in the spirit of somebody who was doing it for the right reasons this whole time, has found success in what they've done and accolades past their own doing, don't let either your fear, which a lot of them, some people wouldn't even have gone up to their people they look up to, and even hung their wares out to those people. Some people just are too afraid.
Yeah,
don't be that either, because the worst that can happen is nothing like you're trying to invent in your head.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, the ego is good to an extent, but if you let it take over, you cheat yourself on really valuable lessons.
On everything.
And also, it's like we were talking about before, the homogenized Americans,
mm-hmm.
Who want to talk about how versed they are, but they aren't willing to experience film on an international level. It just continues to baffle me.
Yeah,
how much is left on the table.
You know, I mean, I've been a fan of Almodovar for years.
Oh, my God. He's,
you know, just unbelievable. But we are getting close to the end of our episode here. So let's wrap it up.
There's a nine.
There's a nine. Yeah.
It's a nine drink for me.
Yeah.
Thing is you mentioned you liked Stephen King's short stories and better than novels. And I think why he probably doesn't like Kubrick's version of The Shining is because it's a short story version of his novel.
Right.
But I think it played better. I think the care went better. So, and it's kind of be kind of hard in the horror genre for me to surpass what I experienced continued to this day from The Shining. But when you're talking about a filmmaker doing a lot with a little and shooting on all cylinders and just like dripping and world building, this movie is hard to beat.
Yep.
It's hard to beat.
It really is. Definitely, I'm like 9, 9.5. I gotta be, this movie blew me away. You know, it's just phenomenal. If you haven't seen it yet, definitely check it out. It was on Amazon Prime.
I mean, in the poetry in the in the language.
Yeah.
I mean, which is why I'm like, I kind of wanted to learn Spanish more.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? So check out El Espinazo del Diablo, The Devil's Backbone. It is available on Amazon Prime. I think it's available on Vudu as well. And probably
available on any on demand, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I think you can get it on YouTube.
Oh yeah,
$2.99
yeah.
or something.
Yeah,
like
but
that.
Do yourself a favor and rent it in HD. I mean, the cinematography is gorgeous.
Oh my God, you don't want to have the choppy standard edition.
Yeah, and you don't want to. You don't want ads either. I mean, because it'll just it's. There are some things that you have to give your full attention.
Like I said, there's a tangible. There's a like you almost want it to be on celluloid in a dark. Like I watched it in a dark theater. Like
I wish I had.
There was a theater in Louisville, Kentucky that was showing it. Called my brain just went blank, can't think of it now, but they showed international films and I was like, I'm gonna go watch The Devil's Backbone just because I looked at what the story said it was as I went and watched it because I was I sucked in anything horror, you know. And I went and watched this movie, and when you see it on this what it was presented on and film and this tangible thing, and everything was crisp and every frame looked like art, and you're just kind of like, you leave a theater in those environments and you're just kind of like you're changed.
Yes.
So exactly. I recommend the best quality you can see this movie in, see it in that quality.
See it in that movie.
And like if you can speak Spanish or you can hear Spanish to some extent, you're going to probably get a lot more out of it. But if you don't speak a lick of Spanish and you can't hear Spanish very well or at all, you not watching this movie for those reasons is just ignorance.
Yeah. This is a beautiful movie. Go check it out. We are just about out of time. Next all right. week. All right. So
what's next week, John? All right.
So in light of the beauty of this movie, I thought, let's just completely do a 180 here on things.
You're not going to do schlock, are you?
We're gonna
video or something like that.
we're gonna revisit somebody that we visited a little while ago. Actually,
oh no,
we're gonna do Mandy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So.
Woo! Have you seen it?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so we're gonna do Mandy next week.
Yes.
Yes. So that's it from here. I am John F. Mers.
And I'm Christopher Grace. I can't
wait
for next week.
Thank you guys for tuning in. We appreciate it. Be sure to like, comment, share below. Give us a drink. Give us a movie recommendation.
Yeah, what movies do you want us to watch?
We'll check them out. Yeah.
You got to dig deep, though, because like I said, don't come at me light. You got to come at me hard.
Yeah, We're not doing Friday the 13th, Jason Takes Manhattan on this podcast. I'm sorry.
We can.
I'm not going to.
But it's not coming. Yeah. You can make a phone call. We'll talk about it.
Yeah, we can just call it.
And I'll drink while we talk on the phone. But it's not. We're not going to go deep diving.
Deep diving. No, there's nothing. No, there's really not. We are out of here, people. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Follow us on YouTube, follow us on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, we're everywhere, so be a part.
Follow
of
me! It. Come quickly!
We will see you next week. Thank you for everything.
Bye.